welcome to another edition of Bird Calls from Red River Radio and from our Knoll Foundation studios. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he's held since 1997. And he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book, Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press. And he has authored over 60 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live deep in East Texas. Cliff, thanks for coming in again tonight.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Bill.
If you have a question for Cliff that you'd like him to answer tonight, anything about birds and our feathered friends, you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And if you have a photo or sound of a bird that you recorded or captured on digital film now, then you can email that to us tonight at our radio address. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Again, that's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. So, Cliff, we decided to profile a very well-known bird throughout the South today, and it's also the key idea in a very famous novel and a movie, and that's the bird, the mockingbird. Can you tell us about this very wonderfully imitative creature?
Well, we picked that bird because it's the state bird of Texas and four other states, two of which are also in our listening area, Arkansas and Mississippi. As a little caveat, the state bird of Louisiana, of course, is the brown pelican. Maybe we'll cover him on a future date. They're pretty mute and quiet, though. But we picked the mockingbird because it's so easily seen and heard, especially in most backyard settings. They're just right there in front of you, and you might not see them or notice what they are or hear or pay attention to their voice, but they're definitely singing in your neighborhood, maybe near your office. They are out there in full numbers, and they're not the jazziest looking bird. They're pretty plain gray and white, but boy, do they make up for it with their voice, mm-hmm. because they're basically listening to other sounds they hear in the environment and imitating it. And that's why they're called the mockingbird. They're kind of making a mockery of everything by saying, hey, I can sing your song and dozens more. But it's not just birds they imitate. They'll do frogs and a squeaky gate and a car alarm and a cat meow. So things that they hear around them over and over, they can pick those up and imitate them. They're also the bird that will chase the squirrel or the cat or the crow or the hawk away. They're very bold in the winter and spring. They'll fall, that when there's a berry giving tree or shrub, they'll protect it and flush other birds away, kind of like, you know, taking pride in their little cupboard or their refrigerator, not letting anybody else take a bite out of their food resource. So they're very bold, and they kind of police the neighborhood in that regard. But you can't find a better mimic in our area. And what they do is they really say it loudly. They're very loud singers, and they say everything in triplicate. So that's kind of interesting, because there are two other mimics in the same that are closely related, the gray catbird and the brown thrasher. But the mockingbird does everything in threes. The thrasher usually in twos, and the catbird singles. So you can tell just by listening, without even seeing the bird, who it is in there imitating. And then I'll add that the thrasher and the catbird are very quiet about it. They're not very loud and boisterous, but boy, when the mockingbird sings, he is screaming it on the top of his lungs. So you can really tell a lot from just 30 to 60 seconds of listening. Even blindfolded, you can tell who it is singing in your backyard. And some backyards can have all three nesting in it. So let's listen to one here.
Now, can you tell some of the birds there that this bird is mocking, the mockingbird is mocking?
If you listen long enough, you can hear things. The one in my backyard, he does a really good tufted titmouse, red-bellied woodpecker. There's a little cardinal there this one's doing. Little bit of Carolina wren probably in that one. And they'll embellish a little bit, and then they practice a little bit. They're not perfect the first time, but I've heard some individuals that are really good at it. They might be older males versus younger males that might be not as experienced. But it's fun to listen to them and see what you can pick out, because you'll hear that squeaky gate that's in your same yard, or that cat you have that meows, and they'll imitate. They'll do the frogs and maybe the insects that you hear. So, and then they'll maybe make something up or fuse a couple sounds together, and you'll say, I can't really tell what that is. But it makes it a lot of fun to listen to the mockingbird.
And they sing this song, but they do other sounds as well. What are they doing when they're not singing the song?
We have, for different context, we have, that was the song. We have also the call of the mockingbird. Here it is.
And see, I hear that all the time.
Yeah, and that's usually when they're that short, paralocation, or he's upset. He's maybe seen a cat nearby. He's scolding you if you're near his nest. So that's very different than when they're singing a song. A song is much more complex. It's a very different context than the call that's not very musical, not very complex, and used in different contexts.
And here's a trivia question for those folks of my generation. I was born in 61, in case you're wondering. Back in the day, there was a cartoon on the air, and they actually wrote a song to the mockingbird on one of these cartoons. What character was it that sang it, and what was the name of the cartoon series? See if anybody can get that one, anybody old enough like me. But right now, we do have our first caller online. By the way, you can give us a call tonight if you've got a question for Cliff, anything about our birds or avian world. The number to call, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Or you can email sound effects or photos to us at Red River Radio Mail @gmail.com. That's Red River Radio Mail, all together, all lowercase, @gmail.com. Our first caller is online. We don't have a name or a location, but we'll go ahead and take that call. You're on the air with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question about birds?
Well, I'm Sarah from Henderson, and we got your book for around Christmas time in the pledge drive, and it's fantastic, so thanks for that.
Great.
I was wondering about hummingbirds. I feel like we missed the boat with getting them to our lawn this season. We put out those hummingbird feeders, and I think they didn't take to it. Do they come back? Do they make more than one nest a year, or do we really just kind of miss our opportunity?
Well, I would say that you have your best opportunity in fall migration, which in our area, you're just 40 miles or so north of me, and I'll tell you that the last 2 weeks of September are when you really want to focus on putting up your feeder, because here come all the northern breeders that are using our area to pass through and refuel like we would on a long journey, and we'd need to stop and get gas for the car and food for our stomach. That's what these birds are doing. They're refueling. So I would say the last 2 weeks of September, you have a really good shot at seeing a lot of hummingbirds. And then this time of the year, yeah, if they're settled in, there's going to be very few. So a lot of people see big numbers in migration. They think, oh, it's going to be the warm season. Look at all these I'm seeing in April. I'm going to see them all the time. Well, those are birds that are doing the opposite of what I said a minute ago. They're going north to breed. And so we just get a few. It thins out that will stay and breed. Right now in my backyard, we have a couple females coming through, and I'll see the male every now and then, but much more the females coming to the feeder. And they really hit it hard at near dusk. And I think that's just to give them a last little bit of juice before bedtime. So I think there's still opportunity. And I'll tell you another trick is not just the feeder, but get some nectar-giving plants in your yard. Those are the neon signs that will attract them. They'll be flying by or over, and they'll see all this red or yellow, and they'll come in. If you just have a feeder, it's really tough to just find that feeder when you're flying around. But if you've got all these other plants in your backyard that are also giving nectar, it's the neon sign saying, vacancy, stop here and refuel.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Sarah.
So would any kind of, you know, flowering plant, nectar-giving plant, when you say nectar-giving, you mean any kind of plant that flowers? Are there ones that, in particular, hummingbirds really prefer?
Your tubular-shaped plants that are native are what you really want to probably start with. Some of the salvias. There's also the Turk's cap is really good. But more of your tubular-shaped plants are the ones that they that design helps a hummingbird stick their bill and their tongue in to get the sweet nectar. And they're helping the plant in the meantime. They're pollinating those plants while they're getting that sweet reward. So I would start with salvias. Those are good. You can put those in pots even if you don't have a backyard. If you're in an apartment setting and you have a balcony, salvias are pretty tolerable about any kind of lighting or crowding. And actually, if you have a flower bed, they'll after about 2 or 3 years, they will start marching and taking over. And that's a good problem to have. You just have to get out there and thin them back if it's getting too crowded with them. But I would start with salvias and look for the native variety here. And those are really good for hummingbirds.
So would things like the petunias and vincas that I have out, would those not be the best plants to grow these in?
A lot of your potted plants that are sold in great numbers at big box stores, those are typically not going to attract hummingbirds or bees. They might buzz by there because, oh, look at that color, but there's just no nectar given to them.
Right.
So a lot of those are just showy. A lot of those are annuals, and they're not designed to give nectar. So not every plant gives nectar. A lot of people see, for example, some of the roses or the bougainvilleas and think, look at all that color. Well, it might attract the hummingbird, but they're going to quickly realize that's not what they want to give them, that sweet nectar.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is currently the non-game statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And he is with us tonight to answer your calls at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Or you can email us a question, a photograph, or a recording of any bird that you would like at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. And we have Vernon from Shreveport next. Vernon, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight about birds?
I have to answer a couple questions, then I'll take my answers off the air. I've lived in Shreveport for 50 years or more, and I'm really surprised at the number of wild birds that are now in the city so much. Because when I was a young man, you never saw doves in the city. And we had, I live out in southeast Broadmoor, and we have some kind of little crane-looking bird that's a water, obviously a marshland bird, brown. And they nest in our trees and raise their young pretty good ways away from water. And I wondered if what might be causing them to move into the city like that. Also, certain times of year, brown thrashers show up all around the house, and then I don't see them anymore. I don't know if they actually migrate or not. And also, there is a bird of some, it's obviously I would call it a strike, but it's like a lightning-billed hawk that you see out over here a lot that just moved in the last year or two. And I wondered if he has any comments on those. The last thing is there anybody who takes in wounded or hurt birds? And I'll hang up. Thank you.
Hang on. We may have a follow-up question for you.
Yeah, your question about the...
he hung up.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't understand one of those about the bird he thought was maybe a shrike, and I wanted to talk to him about that, so I won't address that one. The rehabilitators, in Texas, we have all the licensed rehabbers on the Texas Parks and Wildlife website. You can try to find one that's close to you. And actually, that's a phone number you ought to look up before you need it and put it on the refrigerator, kind of like you would do if with 911 or poison control or something like that. You should, or the sheriff if you're rural, you should have that number on there as well, because what's going to happen when you do find a wounded hawk or something, you're going to take, it's going to take you forever to find the rehabber. So look for that now. Look on your state government's, your Game and Fish's website. So for Texas, where I'm at, you would look on the Texas Parks and Wildlife website. Now, keep in mind, these people are on their own nickel. So, and they are not government employees. They're doing this out of the goodness of their heart. And so they're not everywhere. Bigger cities like Houston, there's lots of them. But then you go into rural areas there, you might have to drive an hour or so, and don't count on them to come get the bird. So you'll have to work that out. The comment, the question about the brown thrashers, they are migratory, and we have very few that stick around through the hot summer months. Instead, what we get is a big influx in fall and throughout the winter. And that's, I bet, when he's seeing them in Shreveport. He's seeing them in the cooler months. Those are northern birds that come down here to winter. But when it starts to warm up, some of those birds decide to go back north. So we have very few. Well, we have they're really in the cities, and that's going to get kind of tied to my next comment that he had, or comments to his next question about why are there more rural birds in the cities. Well, the brown thrasher is one of those that you do find more in the city as a breeder, because the cities have matured with big trees that we planted years and decades ago to shade our houses. Those trees have matured. We have water in the form of bird bath or a dog bowl or a koi goldfish pond. We put out seed. We plant things that give berries and nectar that we mentioned earlier. So I think the cities can be a mecca, and they can be very safe, because a lot of predators, quite a few do also realize this and forage in the cities, but there are a lot of predators that don't forage in the cities. There are a lot of obstacles, and a lot of you lose your ability to pursue things by chasing, or actually by a surprise when you're in the city. If there are lots of birds and all of a sudden, you know, all the birds mob the predator, and then the bird, the owl, is like, oh geez, they found me, and I can't use that moment of surprise to catch prey. So I think there are a lot more birds in the city, because, like dove, because there are all these wonderful things we've done. We didn't do it, it was inadvertently done, but it's really to the liking of a lot of birds. Scissor-tailed flycatcher is one that kind of is impressive to me, that it's such a bird of open prairies or grasslands or pasture, and you'll see them in parking lots and other openings and city parks and city fields. So it's nice that some of these birds are moving the cities. The problem, though, is that for a lot of birds, the city is what we call a sink when they're breeding. For a lot of these birds, they put all this effort into breeding, and there's just so many hazards in the city. Windows to fly into, cats that'll get you, cars that are going to run over you, all these hazards and obstacles that you spend all this time breeding and putting out babies, and they just don't make it. So it could be an illusion. Don't think that cities are a refuge for a lot of these birds. It is for certain things that are really doing well, house sparrows, for example, great-tailed grackles. But there are a lot of birds where it could be a sink. In other words, it's a problem. Even though you're seeing them, they're not multiplying.
Now, he had mentioned doves. Were doves elusive from the city? Because I've always experienced them in, you know, my lifetime in the cities that I've lived in.
Yeah.
Especially mourning doves. What's
happening in the dove world, we're seeing Eurasian collared doves and white-winged doves both moving in the last two decades. And they're really thick in the cities. And again, it's because of bird feeders and bird baths and lots of shade trees. And it's just very comfortable living in the city for a lot of birds. It's not a place for, you know, everything. There are a lot of endangered species. Like when I lived in the Austin area, if you wanted to see golden-cheeked warblers disappear, put in a development, because they did not do well where there was rooftops and noise and so forth. So, but all of a sudden you have a lot of things move in. Here's another example in Austin. It's the Western scrub jays would move out, and here come the blue jays moving in. So you had the one bird, the first one, the scrub jay, the Western scrub jay, that really liked big, unfragmented, quiet forests. And when that was removed and brought in with rooftops and pavement, the blue jays would move in. So you had the changing of the guard, so to speak. Yeah. So it just depends on on the location where you are and what kind of birds are going to move in. But I see lots of doves in the city like he does, and it's just a great place to be for some species.
You're listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and he is with us tonight to take your questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Or you can email us any question, photograph, or sound of a bird that you would like us to identify at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. And we have Catherine on the line from Shreveport next. Catherine, you're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Thank you very much. I actually would first like to address the question of the shrike or the large bird. I also live in southeast Shreveport, and we have, I believe, two nesting pair of peregrine falcon. The, as I understand it, the male makes an address during the nesting time. Am I correct with that?
What do you mean by address? He calls a lot, or he has some place to send mail?
He calls a lot.
I'm sorry. I couldn't resist.
Thank you. He screams his silly head off.
Yeah. Well, peregrine falcons don't breed in Shreveport, so I'm guessing.
Really?
I'm guessing you have. If it is a falcon, I'm guessing they're American kestrels. The old name is sparrowhawk, and that's a pretty common bird in the wintertime, and a few do stick around and nest in cities. We have a few pair of Nacogdoches that breed, and the males are very vocal, kind of a killy 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 killy. Killy, 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 over and over. So that's the kestrel. And they look, they're not the same color, definitely not the same size of, as a falcon, but at a distance they have that kind of same cookie-cutter shape, which is typical of all the falcons.
Right.
But his coloring is very different. He's much smaller, and he's eating much smaller prey. But you could have peregrines in Shreveport, but they're going to be migrants mostly, and maybe a few winter birds, but they're going to probably leave the cities and go out into more rural areas for extended stays.
This is a rural area.
Okay.
I have the levee behind me and a lake behind the levee.
Yeah, then you might have one hanging around for an extended period in the fall or winter, but not for nesting.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, he makes a lot of noise.
Yeah. Well, check it out this time. And before you do, go look at, online or in your bird book for kestrel,
okay. American
kestrel. He's going to be in the same part of the book as the peregrine. He's in the same genus, Falco. And just look him up first and then go out in the field and see if he matches in the book that bird. If it doesn't, we're on every other month, so call us
okay.
back. And also, when Bill mentioned that we take photographs and sound recordings, you don't have to do that today. So you have now homework. You can go out and try
there
to get
go.
A photograph and or a sound bite and send that to us anytime between now and whenever. And,
okay.
and we'll address it in a future episode of Bird Calls. So how's that
well,
sound?
I have very good view of him because he sits on a pole, an electric pole, across the levee behind my house.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see him almost daily.
Yeah.
And sitting back
and
there.
And kestrels are cavity nesters, so if you watch him, he's going to go into an old hollow, maybe an old abandoned pileated woodpecker hole.
Mm-hmm.
Or I've seen them nesting in downspouts, which is not a good spot in buildings. And so it's fine as long as it's not raining. But as soon as we get a deluge and all those rooftops start draining, those pipes start filling with water, and whoosh, there goes the eggs and nestlings and all the nest material. So that the thing they're looking for is that cavity, and sometimes those drain pipes really look like that and are attractive to them, but boy, it can be a sink for that bird.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. The other one is I have a bird in my backyard that I'm greeted with every morning, and she says cheery, cheery, cheery.
cheery, cheery, cheery. And do you ever see that bird, or is it?
No,
it's hiding?
I've never laid eyes on it.
I'm guessing it's Carolina Wren. We featured that bird in the past, and Bill has it, and he's going to pull it up in here in the morning. How about this one? Is this it?
No.
No?
Mm-mm. No.
Let's keep listening. And they can sound a little different. They can change that a little bit, but it's they're loud. They're in our backyards, and they say the same thing over and over. It could be part of the cardinal song that you're hearing, and we featured him before. And that one, try this one.
Uh-uh.
No? Okay.
No.
Well, guess what? You have another homework assignment, Catherine. You've got to record it. And let me tell you, if you've got a smartphone like I do, you can use the video function. And don't worry about getting the image of the bird in the video. Just hold it up and grab that sound out of the air and record it that way.
Or if you have a picnic table or anything in your backyard, if you walk away and you have enough space on your phone, he will start singing, because sometimes they do quiet down when we approach. So I go out and record stuff all the time, and they don't like me. But if I walk away and leave the recorder, they just are happy as a lark.
Just keep going. I hear you. A lark? Yes.
Yes. I don't know. Are larks really happy?
Like dead pigs.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your information.
Thank you, Catherine.
All right, dear. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can call us right now with your question at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now, so you can get right in. Or if you have a question you'd like to email us, just send it to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. And we'll go ahead and get that right in here. I do have a question for you. We had mentioned doves earlier. What's the difference between doves and pigeons?
Well, that's a good question. We get that a lot with what's the difference in a parrot, a parakeet, a heron, and an egret. And there's not really a good answer for that, because there are some, you know, you could say it's size, but there are some birds with the name pigeon as part of the name that are smaller than some birds with the name dove in their name. So it's just all about the naming and the person that's naming the bird, but there's really no good formula for, is that an egret or a heron, or should that be a parrot or a parakeet? It's just all in the name.
Well, I think the reason I ask, because doves you think of as these pretty white birds, the bird of peace, and pigeons you don't want anywhere near your house because they just make nasty nests and do nasty things all over the place. So
right, and there's probably 300 species of pigeons and doves on the planet. We only have, of course, a small handful of those here in the listening area, but there's no good rule for that yet. Usually, though, typically pigeons are larger, doves are typically smaller, but that's not always the case.
Is it also a coloration thing? Because doves are typically thought of, I mean, typically, maybe wrongly, but as of white.
Yeah, and most of the doves around our area that are native are a pale shade of gray or tan brown. So they're more earth tone colors. If you see a white dove, it's not a native wild bird. It's a caged bird.
Okay.
Those probably have some pigeon blood in them too. So a lot of those are actually pigeons, but they sell them as doves, you know, white doves.
Because
so.
Nobody's going to buy a pigeon.
Yeah,
but a couple of love doves, you know, they'll do that. You are listening to Bird Calls tonight with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Or you can email us at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Brad from Pollock, you're on the line with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Good evening. I heard a bird back in the spring, and I never saw it, I haven't heard it since then. I was in the Little River Basin, which is a good-sized hardwood bottom. I was in a cutover. The bird sounded like somebody tapping pool balls together. He'd do it about three times, and he'd stop for a little while, and he'd do it again. But I never saw him.
Hmm. What was the habitat like? You said it's a big hardwood bottom. Was it shady?
No, sir. It was a cutover. Oh, okay. Yeah. There was 10, 15 years of growth in it.
Okay. You know, Well, I'm guessing, and I've heard a lot of them this year. There are frogs that are doing that, and they sound like two rocks hitting together. And so there are several frogs that were just really going bonkers. Because think about May and June in our area, and you're not far from me in Pollock. We had a lot of rain, didn't we? And so those cutover areas will hold water, and they'll become temporary breeding ponds for a bunch of different frogs. So the upland chorus frog, maybe you can hear those. And I'm guessing you had a frog and not a bird.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was up, but I guess so.
Yeah, and there are a lot of frogs that do sound like birds. We mentioned this in a previous show. I get a lot of calls at Parks and Wildlife about, what's that songbird singing in the dead of night? And it's making this chirp, 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 and it's a frog. It's the...
Oh, I got a songbird that sings in the dead of night. For the last week or so, I've got a mockingbird outside the window.
Well, that's
off about midnight.
Well, that's appropriate you brought that up, because we're highlighting the mockingbird today. And those are typically your unmated males in hyperdrive. Their hormones are going. They're really putting in over time trying to get a girlfriend. So
sunrise sets them off.
Yeah, and the moon makes it a lot easier to sing, because you give away your location when you're singing, and there's a lot of things that can creep up and sneak up on you in the dark, especially when you're a diurnal bird that can't see well at night. But the moonlight really helps, or a big security light. So if you've got a problem with a mockingbird singing all night, turn off your security light, and you'll probably solve it. He'll go somewhere else.
All right, thank you much.
Yeah.
No light, but I'll just go out there and shake him every night, I guess.
Yeah, and the next time you hear the two pool balls hitting each other, go out there and see, and I bet you all of a sudden your shoes are going to get wet and nothing's going to fly away. They'll get quiet, because they'll be like, who's that? And they'll get real quiet, but you just walked up on a breeding pond of frogs.
All right.
Yep.
Thank you much.
Uh-huh.
Now, could those be tree frogs too? Because tree frogs do go up in the trees, obviously.
Yeah, but the tree frogs come down towards the ground to breed, and we have two or three species of tree frogs that one of them sounds very bird-like, and the gray tree frog can sound very bird-like, and then there's the green tree frog that makes it doesn't sound like a bird. It's obnoxious. There's cricket frogs. There's all kinds of little guys that make lots of noise that can sort of sound bird-like. And I'm telling you, this June, they were prolific. We had so much standing water, and the frogs really, really respond to that. This was a good June for frogs for breeding.
Which means good food for a whole lot of other animals.
That's true.
So the predators. You are listening to Bird Calls and possibly also Frog Calls here on Red River Radio tonight with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Park and Wildlife Department. He's with us tonight to answer your calls at 800-552-8502. We go next to Bill from Alto. Bill, you're on the line with Cliff. What's your question?
Okay, I'm trying to distinguish between the indigo bunting and the painted bunting. I listen to it on the tapes and at my desk, and I say, well, I see that. But as soon as I get outside, I hear what I call a bunting sound. I say, well, that's a bunting. But I just can't distinguish them when I'm outside, without a recording next to me. Is there anything that I can rule one in or one out?
Yeah, to me, those two don't sound alike, because the indigo bunting says everything in paired notes.
Okay.
And what I like to use to memorize birds are what we call handles. Mm-hmm. And the handle I use, and what I mean by handle, it's like a hand tool where you have to grab hold of the tool with the handle part. Well, this is the handle on a bird song is what you grab. It's the tool to grab hold of to help you remember it.
Yeah.
So what I use for the indigo bunting, it sounds like he's saying quick, quick, fire, fire, where, here, here. So notice how everything was in twos.
Uh-huh.
The painted bunting doesn't do that at all. His is very warbly and goes on a lot longer, and actually the painted bunting song sounds very much like the blue grosbeak. So those are really tough to tell apart, painted bunting and blue grosbeak.
Oh, we have the blue grosbeak.
Yep. So you might even have a third bird species to deal with out there in Alto, because you'll have all three of those: indigo bunting, painted bunting, and blue grosbeak. So the key the key for me is to see the face while you're hearing it, and it all of a sudden it just comes together. So I would say go out with your binoculars and try to see who's singing. But first go listening for that quick fire where here. Then you'll know it's the indigo bunny. He's all blue, but so is the blue grosbeak, but his voice is very different. And I'm talking about difference from John Lennon to Mick Jagger. It's that different. Yeah.
And Bill, also, if you get a chance to record that, send that recording in to us here at Red River Radio, and we'll use that on our next show.
Right. That's right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Right. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. You can call in right now at 800-552-8502 or email us at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. We go next to John from Kennard, Texas. John, you're on the line with Cliff. What's your question?
Thank you. For about 8 or 10 years, back in the woods that I live in, I've had what I call a mystery bird, and I've gone to the Cornell website to listen to sounds, and I could never identify it until about 2 years ago, and the sound I used to hear, well, I still hear, would be late in the afternoon about dusk, and in the morning just as it was getting light, and it was a chirring sound. I could see the silhouette of the bird. It's about the size of a mockingbird, but I never could see enough light to even tell what color it was. And then one evening I was walking down my road about almost dark, and I scared a bird out of a tree, and it made a sound like two pieces of chert hitting together, a flint. And that reminded me of the call you got a couple of times back about the sound of two rocks hitting together.
Mm-hmm.
And about 2 or 3 months later, two of these birds flew up as I was working in the garden and made that same exact sound that I'd been hearing for, I know, at least 7 or 8 years. And it turned out to be a brown thrasher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, that sounds like a laser gun. It's kind of like a chirp, 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 chirp. And that's an alarm call that the brown thrasher gives, and that's that's great that you finally identified it, because, it's tough when you hear something you really want to know what it is, and it's difficult to see. And brown thrashers are very thicket-loving and hard to spot. But once you learn that laser call, there are a lot of brown thrashers out there, especially starting in October and going into April. That's really when they're here. October through April is when you have a lot of brown thrashers making that call in the thickets. And that's their call note. And do yours stick around and breed? Do you have them year-round in Kennard?
Yes.
Okay.
Not many, but I can hear them year-round usually.
Yeah.
But the chirring sound, and that's probably not a good word to describe it, is what I hear mostly. And it's just like a clock, especially in the fall, about deer hunting season. And I first heard it when I was on a deer stand. I'd hear this chirring sound, and I knew it was a bird because I could see it moving when it made the sound. And I've never been able to hear that sound on any recording of any of the sources I've looked at.
Yeah.
I read that the brown thrasher has maybe more sounds than the mockingbird, but I don't hear them. At least if I hear them in the woods, I don't recognize them as the brown thrasher.
Right, right. And so what you keep hearing is the call note, but the song is what you'd hear this time of the year, and it's just a bunch of imitations similar to the mockingbird. And like I said earlier, it doesn't sing it quite as loud, and it's usually in twos and not threes like the mockingbird. But the description the other fellow said with the two pool balls, as in billiards, to me, it's a little different. That gives a really dry clicking note, and that to me, he had the frog. And without a recording, we won't ever know, but we have to try to do our best. And so your bird has a very different sound to it than what's described as two billiards or balls or rocks hitting each other. So yours, to me, sounds more electrified and a little bit laser gunish, which of course is, not something that's real, but I think most people can understand that. But then, that doesn't work for everybody. You might have a different description for what you hear. So it's tough to put a verbal words to something like a bird sound, because we don't always agree on what it sounds like.
It's a beautiful bird, and I've only seen it three times out of the thicket, once at a bird feeder, and I didn't recognize that as the mystery bird at that time, and once on a branch when it was full of light and I could see it, and one other time. So those are thrills for me. And so it's been a nice pursuit to find out what that bird is. So
yeah. Well,
thank you very much.
You bet. In Kennard, I used to eat at a little restaurant called the Burlap Bag or Burlap Sack. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's been closed for a long time, but I used to do a lot of work out in the Davy Crockett, and that was the go-to place for lunch. And it's been closed for, 10 or 15 years?
Yeah, we still miss that.
Yeah. Yep.
It was great.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Enjoy your show very much.
Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, who is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and he is with us tonight to answer your calls about anything relating to our feathered friends, the avian world, or birds. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 to call in with your question. If you'd rather email us, you can. Just send an email, a photo, or a sound to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Corey from Ore City, Texas, you are on the line with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Well, we have a wading bird around the pond at our house. We hadn't been able to. I can't decide if it's black or if it's so black it's blue.
Hmm.
But it's got a blue tinge to it. Of course, it's got a long neck and kind of a old dirty orange leg, and it makes a kind of a call
mm-hmm.
that I hadn't been able to identify.
Is he in the water?
They stand right at the edge of it.
Okay. And when you say black or almost blue, is he pretty much just one color or is there many colors involved?
Pretty much just one color.
Okay. My guess is that it's a little blue heron. They're at any size water hole, bar ditches, ponds, big lakes even, any size water, and they're really dark, especially in the shadows. They just look one color dark. They can look black in the shade. And then when the light hits it, they're a kind of a purpley blue. They can it just depends on the lighting, but they're one color, pretty much one color. And that's what I'm guessing you have. It's again called little blue heron. And you can look it up after we talk and see if you agree. Because there's also the great blue heron, but he's multiple colored. He's the one that the old timers call blue crane. And he's just a very different bird and stands
we get them
tall.
A lot. We're
yeah.
talking catfish.
Yes.
We do see the great blue heron.
So if you know the size of the great blue heron, the little blue heron is a little bit less than half that size.
That's about it.
So yeah, I'm guessing little blue heron.
And they're migratory because we see them in the spring and summer. But
they don't winter with us. That's not a bird you're expected to see in the wintertime. They pretty much get the heck out of here by the second or third cold front. They're all gone.
Okay, sounds about right. We've got some that are in residence every year, and they seem to like it there. It's quiet out.
Yeah, and what's neat about that bird, the first year birds are completely white. And then the next year, the birds that were born right now, if you see one that was born in 2013, it's going to have a little bit of gray coming in and a little bit of white, and they just look like a white bird that got a little bit of campfire ash on it here and there. And it gives a very cool, neat look, I think, that gives it a gray and white look. And that's still a little blue heron. He just hasn't reached adulthood. So it's the second year is when they get that plumage that you described earlier. So that's a full adult. But what's neat is if you see his young bird of this year, he's going to look the color of a cattle egret or snow egret. But you have to look at the legs and the bill to know that it's a first-year little blue heron.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think they are in residence because we have been seeing more cattle egret around. So
yeah.
I guess they're probably not then, huh?
Well, there are cattle egret. They'll nest together. So the little blue herons and the cattle egrets and other wading birds will nest together in what we call a rookery or a heronry, and there's safety in numbers. And you'll see them nesting side by side. But usually the cattle egrets outnumber the little blues by 10 or 20 or more to 1.
Oh, yeah.
They're just a lot of cattle egrets.
Adolescence.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that takes care of that. It's been a mystery around my parents' place for a couple seasons now.
And what's the bird's name again?
The little blue heron.
Very good. A plus.
All right.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And a curious question, is Anhinga, is that related at all to the herrings?
No, he's not related to the herons. He is related to the cormorants.
Okay.
And the pelicans. So he's a different kind of bird. And you'll see the Anhinga nesting with the herons, usually up higher. Mm-hmm. And there's safety numbers there, but they are not related. They're just taking advantage of those the safety of the rookery or the heronry.
I'm just curious. We saw tons of Anhingas in Florida where I was at. I mean, just huge flocks of sandhill cranes, Anhingas, herons, the whole bit.
Right.
I mean, all kinds of beautiful birds.
Right. Neat. And we have lots of Anhingas here in the Red River Radio listening area, and they look like a cormorant, but they have a long tail, mm-hmm. and you'll see them flap, 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 glide, and you'll see them soaring around like raptors. They'll find a thermal, and you'll see them spiraling around, and as they're doing that, that's you know a thermal, that's hot air rising off the earth. They get lift with that, so it makes it very easy to go from, say, 500 feet to 1,000 feet by just letting the hot air do it for you. So you'll see Anhinga, especially in the fall, they'll get into flocks, and you'll see them soaring, and you'll think, what are those? Are those hawks? But look at that long tail, and they're Anhingas. So they're really a neat bird, and they're in our waters fishing. And then, like we mentioned, they're nesting in those heronries alongside little blue herons.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, who is the statewide non-game ornithologist with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. You can call in right now at 800-552-8502. If you have a question for Cliff, that is 800-552-8502. Any question concerning our birds, or email us at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. And we have Michael from Natchitoches online next. Michael, you're on the line with Cliff. What's your question?
I have a quick question. I heard you refer to an American kestrel a few minutes ago in the show, and there's a bird that I hear every now and then above where I live, and it'll be a high-pitched whistle like a hawk, just a and I'll look up, and there'll be one, and sometimes two of the birds just large circling around the house. I'm assuming just, as you said just a minute ago, riding the thermals, and I was wondering if that bird might be the American kestrel.
No, the kestrel was the one I imitated that makes the killy, 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 really noise, okay. Killy, killy sound. There are a couple of Butios, what the genus Butio, big raptors that make sounds similar to what you mentioned, and you'll hear them in your area. The most common that you'll hear for many, many months of the year is the red-shouldered hawk, and it makes a loud crying song over and over. You'll look up and you'll see them. But also this time of the year there are broad-winged hawks, and they make usually a single whistling note, and you'll look up and there's a little speck way up there. So I'm guessing it's going to be either broad-winged hawk or red-shouldered hawk that you're hearing. And if you go back and listen again, if it's the same note with lots of pauses and just kind of a whistle, it's going to be the broad-winged. If it's kind of a then it's going to be the red-shouldered hawk.
Okay, no, it's definitely a long whistle like the television does when a bomb goes.
Oh,
like
that's a great. Yeah, I love that. That's broad-winged hawk. There's bigger pauses though. Usually they don't usually do it over and over like that. But I like that description. And they are pretty secretive nesting birds in our area. It's a tough bird to find at the nest. But if you get tuned into that call like you already are, you can find them. And if you hear one, usually they're soaring pretty high up.
Exactly.
And vocalizing.
That's the only time I've ever really noticed it. I hear the call and I look up, and there one or two are flying in big circles around the house.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like broad-winged hawks. And that's a bird that's going to leave us in the winter months. They'll leave in September and not return until April. So they do not overwinter with us. But when they're here, they're very secretive, except for what you describe when they're courting or maintaining that territory. You'll see and hear them. But otherwise, they're pretty darn secretive and skulking and do a pretty good job hiding.
Okay.
Yeah, broadwing hawk.
Well, thank you so very much.
Yep, you bet.
All right, thank you, Michael. Now I have a question. You hear a kind of a screeching hawk sound in a lot of movies, a very famous sound effect from the Cornell Library. Is that's the redwing hawk, is it not?
That's the red-tailed hawk.
Red-tailed hawk,
and
yeah.
On some movies, you'll hear them dub that with a view of a turkey vulture.
Right, anything. Yeah.
So and that was probably fine 50 years ago, but now there are a lot more people that are tuned into that, and they're going to write letters saying you guys goofed up.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't mess that one up in
no.
Florida, that's for sure, and probably not here in Louisiana. You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist and the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and you can call him right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, or email us at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Holly Lynn from Nacogdoches, you are online with Cliff Shackelford. Holly, what's your question tonight?
Hey, Cliff, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good.
I don't have a question so much as I'd like to give kudos to the cormorants. A lot of people just consider them ugly, oily, weird birds, but when I visited my mother in Florida a lot, I would enjoy so much watching them go down under, come up, go down under, come up, and then sit on a little piling and just sit there patiently drying the oil off of their wings all spread out. And to me, that was a beautiful phenomenon, and I don't think cormorants have gotten their due.
No, the cormorant is very much hated by anglers. It's seen as a competitor. Because the cormorant's also after fish. But I think what's interesting is, you know, you saw a little bit of nature, you paid attention, and you enjoyed what you saw.
Mm-hmm.
And that,
absolutely.
I think that's what people are lacking in life. And it doesn't mean they have to look at birds, but I think if they pick something that's not plugged in, something that doesn't use batteries or electric current, and can enjoy it, whether it's a butterfly feeding on their plants or like you seeing a cormorant feeding, to me, that you have a greater appreciation for things that are around you that matter. And so I think that, you know, whether you like or dislike cormorants, I think if you just take the time like you did and watch them, it is pretty neat. It's amazing how they can go under. You're like, okay, I could count to 30, 35, 40. Where is he?
And they'll pop.
It's pretty neat. It's pretty neat. They'll pop up and, you know, they don't catch a fish every time. They're just like that angler. Just because they go fishing doesn't mean that they're successful every time. But they are neat to watch. And I'm guessing that you saw neotropic cormorants.
On the Gulf Coast of Florida.
Okay. And it depends on the month when you can really see the double crest in big numbers. But the neotropic cormorants are in smaller numbers. They're going to be really interesting to watch. If you look with binoculars, they have a pale blue eye, almost a baby blue eye. They're really, really neat looking. And, you know, other than that, you know, this doesn't have a lot of color or pizzazz, but it's kind of like you said, it's the behavior that's neat to see what they're doing to survive. How does this bird make a living? And you witness that, and that's really cool.
Yes, I think so too.
Good. Well, thank you.
And, of course, you can get to any wetlands throughout this area and probably see a wide variety of birds. So if you want to get out from the electrified world and go out and see some of the natural beauty, it's very easy to see.
And wetlands are the best place to get started. If you've never really paid attention to birds, go to a wetland because you don't have bushes and trees in the way. The birds are typically larger. And sometimes they're approachable. You're going to need some binoculars. But wetlands are a great place to look. In the wintertime, you might have ducks. They're sizable. Versus going into the woods, a lot of the birds are little. They're up in, you know, 80 feet up in the canopy, and they're hard to see. And that can be very challenging. Well, that might not be for the beginner. So the beginner should go to the wetland, go to a pond, a lake, a reservoir, go to the coast and find on the birding trail something with a, maybe a site with a pier that you can walk out and look out on the wetland. And if it's a heavily birded site, the birds get acclimated to the people. And I've looked right down on least bitterns before at some of our birding trail sites on the coast because the bird watchers don't pose a threat to the bird. And there's the habitat. He likes it. And it's such a great setting to go to a wetland and see birds up close and personal.
Now, if you are a bird lover and you're out, and I do this all the time, I go out and I see these high-flying birds that either look like hawks, I'm not sure if they're falcons, eagles. Is there a way to easily distinguish what kind of, you know, of that bird of prey it is when they're way up in the sky? Is there a flight pattern? Is there a particular wing flapping pattern or thing like that that I could look for to distinguish the various birds that I see?
There are some books that are designed for hawk watchers that help, but it's such a specific book you're not going to find it in your local bookstore, and it's a challenge for, indeed. But what I like to recommend, and most people have good cameras now, is take a bunch of pictures and then keep looking. But you have the pictures because when the bird flies off, then you have something to continue studying, or send it to us. And actually, that's a good point to bring up that I'm glad you brought up because. Very soon, we're going to start seeing a lot of Mississippi kites migrating through our area. Now, Mississippi kites might be a backyard bird for some of you, like in the if you're in the Red River Valley, you've got them nesting. But where I'm at, we don't have a whole lot of nesting Mississippi kites. But here they come in August as migrants, and they're soaring around, and they're usually fairly low. And if you didn't know what they were, you'd be like, "What is that? Is that a hawk? Is that a falcon? What is it?" Well, it's a Mississippi kite, and they're flying low over the trees, usually going after dragonflies or other large insects that are flying above the canopy, but namely dragonflies is what they're getting. But to answer your question, it's really practice that really makes it easy to identify birds on the wing. But like I said, if you're a beginner, take pictures, and good cameras are pretty cheap nowadays. And you can zoom in if you're taking five or bigger megapixel pictures. You can zoom in and you can share those with us or someone else and study it later. So take the picture and then try to identify it because it really, really helps.
You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. And we have a question coming in right now. Where are the whippoorwills around here?
Okay. Was that an online question?
Yes.
Okay. And we have whippoorwills go through our listening area in late March, early April, and they're really replaced with chuckwills widows that stick around and breed here. And so I'm guessing that the caller has chuckwills widows. And they actually, when a lot of birds like that finish breeding, they get quiet. They might be changing gears and spending all that time feeding young that are getting big and hungry, and the need for song isn't as necessary. For example, you're singing because you might be looking for a mate or maintaining your territory. Well, let's say you got all that under control and you got babies. Well, you don't need to sing as much. You need to spend that time feeding young, and that's probably what they're doing, but I'm guessing that the caller had chuckwills widows. But listen for whippoorwills in late March, early April of 2015 when they're pouring through.
All right. You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist and the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Cliff, thanks again once again for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
This program has been produced by me, Bill Beckett, with help from Renee Moran, Laura Moran, and Wally Derleth. And we want to thank everybody for calling in tonight. The audio for this will be posted on our website in about an hour, hour and a half, if you'd like to listen back. This program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of Louisiana. I'm Bill Beckett, your host. Stay tuned. We have Radiolab coming up next.
You have been listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. We are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. This is KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria-Pineville, KBSA El Dorado-Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin-Nacogdoches. Our next edition of What's Bugging You is going to be coming up in August. That's going to be on August 19th. And then our next edition of Bird Calls will take place on September 16th. We hope you'll tune in for those programs. Thank you for calling in tonight. And stay tuned. Radio Lab is next.